This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 180.
But there was this remarkable study that shows that there's a direct correlation between week-to-week productivity and key performance metrics and how people feel week-to-week on their own self-assessment. How would you judge your well-being? If it's bright green, performance goes up. If it's bright red, performance goes down and everything in between. And I was like, eureka, this is completely aligned everything. Simplify. But you used the word feel 4 or 5 times a moment ago. And we've never concerned ourselves with how people feel. But it's feelings and emotions that drive human behavior. It's not up here. This is one of the main theses of Lead from the Heart, is that we need to be thinking about how people feel and not how they think. So when we do a pulse survey, we ask them, how do you feel this week? We don't go, how did you think about your week? And it tells you everything you need to know.
How can organizations make employee well-being a leadership responsibility, not just the employee's responsibility? Why is belonging the number one driver of employee well-being?
Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Most HR teams are executing better than ever, and yet many CHROs are wrestling with the same question. Are we truly creating enterprise value or just delivering excellent support? After interviewing more than 150 CHROs and senior HR leaders, one thing is clear: execution excellence is now table stakes. And while execution earns trust, value creation is what differentiates the best HR teams. That insight led me to create my keynote presentation, Future Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow. This isn't a motivational talk. It's a practical roadmap for helping HR leaders move beyond execution and step into a new standard of leadership, evolving from business partners to true value creators. I've delivered this keynote for HR teams at companies like AbbVie, Nike, Corning, Kohler, and LabCorp. And if you're planning an HR conference or leadership event and want your team to leave thinking and operating at a higher level, visit futureofhr.com to get in touch. Let's design a keynote that meets the moment HR is in right now and helps your team show up differently because of it. And with that, my guest this week is Mark C. Crowley. Mark's a pioneering leader in workplace leadership, a best-selling author, a speaker, and the host of the acclaimed Lead from the Heart podcast. In his first book, Lead from the Heart, published in 2011 and now in its second edition, Mark challenged leaders to lean into the human connection to unlock their team's performance and potential. And Mark's back with a new book, The Power of Employee Well-Being: Move Beyond Engagement to Build Flourishing Teams, which challenges organizations to replace outdated engagement metrics with a focus on what truly drives performance, how people feel. In my conversation with Mark, we explore why the employee engagement industry has failed to improve our workplaces, what the research actually says about the link between well-being and performance, why belonging is the number one driver of well-being, and why HR needs the courage to lead this shift. I'd love to hear your thoughts this episode, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And with that, here's my conversation with Mark. Mark, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I am wonderful. Can we tell everyone that we just had a great conversation before, or is that going to annoy some people to know we talked about some stuff?
No, we broke the fourth wall. Yeah, that does happen. We actually had a conversation, a great conversation, and really good to get to know you personally a little bit before we have this conversation, because we hadn't had that opportunity. In researching everything, you've done a lot. You know, you've been writing books. Your first book, Lead from the Heart, came out in 2011, and that's well before we talked about well-being as a mainstream conversation, before people were just really thinking about that. What led you to write Lead from the Heart, gosh, almost more than a decade ago?
Yeah, it's coming up on 15 years ago, which is crazy. The short answer to a long question is that it's really been a lifelong journey for me. It started with, I'll just give you a quick summary of it. My mom died when I was 9, and I was raised from that point forward by my father, who was actually a really successful guy in business, one of the top people in General Electric, but he never should have been a parent to his children, and especially to me. Psychologically, emotionally abusive, really tried to whittle down any self-esteem I had. And then he kicked me out of the house right after I graduated from high school with no support of any kind. Saw him 4 or 5 times over the next 15 years, most of them in the hospital before he died. Never apologized. But he really did a whammy on me in terms of setting me up to fail. But he had predicted that I was going to be this abject failure in my life. And I heard that voice loud and clear. And so it became this binary outcome for me. If I don't graduate from college, I'm going to be the guy he said I would be. So by hook or by crook, I graduated from college, actually graduated with honors. They should have kicked me out the first couple of years because it's such a destabilizing period. But I got to college graduation, graduated from University of California, San Diego, one of the top public schools in the country. It was very rigorous. When I'm graduating, I'm still hearing my dad's voice about not being that guy and like I didn't earn it. And I'm talking to people that are graduating. They're like, oh, I'm going off to Harvard Business School or I'm going to law school or I'm doing this and these prestigious universities. And I'm thinking, how come you think you can go and I don't think I can go? And I realized like their upbringings gave them the stability that I'd never had. I really deeply looked at it and said, what was it that I didn't get that they got that made them so confident to apply to schools that I thought nobody's going to want me, even though my challenge to graduate was much more difficult than that. I had a better story. I didn't believe my own story. So when I started managing people, I unconsciously decided to give people everything that I always wanted, almost like an experiment. How much more could I have been at that age, 23 years old, when I graduated from college? If I had had more care and support, more thoughtful direction and more encouragement, more safety and love. For reasons I can't explain, I went out and started managing people and I was 43 years old, basically 20 years later, when a woman who had worked for me almost all that time came into my office, just stormed into my office. And she's just like, you realize you manage people very differently compared to everyone else around you, don't you? And I said, well, what do you mean? She started giving me these examples. And it was just like, ooh, this epiphany of, oh my God, all of this was because of that. My upbringing influenced it. So I'm not thinking about you and I having this conversation all these years later. I'm thinking, hey, I have figured something out here that by giving people all this, they become not only willing to scale mountains for you, but capable of scaling mountains for you. So I just started perfecting it. Here's the punchline. When I left my corporate position and very, very senior level position in one of the largest financial institutions. I'd just been named leader of the year. And do I have a book in me? Can I tell people these practices and influence them? Like a Buddha, a friend of mine knew what I was up to, called me up one day and said, you're going to have to explain why all this works. And I hadn't given it any thought. I just thought people would just take me at my word that if you care about people deeply in the way that I did, that you will support them in a way that will optimize their performance. People weren't going to believe that is what he said. So I went and met with a world-class cardio surgeon and said, I think I was affecting the hearts in people. That's what I think. Just between us chickens. Like, so if you think this is insane, it's only us knowing it. And she said, and I literally had tears coming down my eyes. She goes, you have figured out something. We're just figuring out medicine. We now believe that the heart is not just a pump, that it's actually communicating with the brain 24/7, sends more signals to the brain than the other way around. So when people are feeling what you are doing, you're giving people these positive emotions that the heart is very much involved in signaling to the brain that, hey, this feels pretty good and we want to reciprocate and do great work for them. So when I wrote Lead from the Heart, and I was heavily advised to call it killer engagement or anything else than what I called it, it was to say that scientifically, we're managing people in a way that is completely misaligned to human nature. That's beginning of the journey of where we are today.
Incredible story. Thanks for being so candid and telling that story. I think
a lot of us don't always go back to think about how we're raised and how that plays out as adults. Our insecurities, our areas where we focus, the voice that we're hearing when we're sitting in our room alone at night or on an airplane, your AirPods on, or whatever happens to be, you know, that's really important. And I think what's interesting is that drove you to then do something really different and do it in a way that is, unfortunately, I wish we didn't have to do that. Yeah, I wish people understood that that makes the most sense. Like, you shouldn't even have to write a book called Lead from the Heart, unfortunately, Mark, but you do, because it's so rare that people sort of look past the work and say, hey, let me get to know who you really are and let's engage at a level where we want to both be successful. I want you to succeed. You want me to succeed. I want to know what matters to you. I want to motivate you. And I know, I believe you can get work done without me yelling at you. But unfortunately, I think we need more Lead from the Heart today than ever, frankly.
I'll give you an example. I was supposed to speak at Amazon. Jeff Bezos is still there. And somebody had read the book and said, God, man, do we need you? And so I got all excited. And 2 days before, they called me up and said, oh, we decided it's just going to be an internal meeting and we're not going to have any outside speakers. And I was like, okay, I know that's not true, but I wonder what happened. So a couple of years later was COVID. I got this request from Microsoft. These two gentlemen wanted to talk to me. And so we had a call. During the call, they said, we really think that this would be a great thing to do right now during COVID. So can you do this virtually? And I said, absolutely. And they said, well, you know, the one person who is speaking, he says, you know, are you doing a lot of this? And I said, well, I am, but not for Microsoft. And he goes, well, who else? And so I said, well, there are major companies that are interested in this, but they're a little bit leery of it. I'll give you an example. I got hired to speak at Amazon, but at the last minute they canceled it. And I think they canceled it because they were like, hell no, we need somebody who can drive success and performance, which of course everything that I talk about does, but they just intuited that it doesn't. The guy, the other guy goes, I'm that guy. I was at Amazon. And I'm like, you're kidding me. And he goes, you're right. He goes, my boss came in and said, who's the speaker? And he goes, didn't even like clean it up for me. He was like, F that. We're not bringing that guy in. Tell him we need somebody who can drive performance. That's the challenge that I've faced for all this time, is that you hear the word heart and you immediately dismiss it as he's a religious guy, a spiritualist, or a nut. He doesn't get business. And what I'm saying the whole time is that something you suggested a minute ago, my books are filled with proof. Because like, I shouldn't have had to write these books. We should know this intuitively. And I think we do know it intuitively. But in order to get people to go, nah, heart, that's just going to slow us down. Well, you don't need to know people and we don't really need to care about them and all that kind of stuff. I'm trying to demonstrate that there's a science behind this that actually supports doing this. I'm trying to get people to go here by coming up here and go, here's the proof you need.
Yeah, incredible stories to hear that. And it's not surprising. I think some companies and some individuals might believe we hear the word heart and think about it as being soft. But when we talk about care, connection, what really matters for people to give their best effort, people have to really feel like they belong. They want to get along. They want to get ahead. They want to find meaning at their companies, at work, right? We spend a lot of time here. And so we want to make sure that we're doing that in that space. But I love you started there and just let Lead with the Heart be your only hit. You come back now with a new book, The Power of Employee Well-Being. What was the aha moment that made you get back to writing and talking about another topic that some people might say, gosh, that sounds really soft, like well-being? A company care about my well-being. What's powerful about that?
So there were two things that happened. One was this, honest to God, when COVID hit and the gyms closed, I just started walking the beach every morning at 5 o'clock and finding out this is pretty magical time. I'm the only person out there. It's dark. And some people, including my wife, think it's insane, but I love it. One day I'm walking off the beach and this word primer hit me. I actually wrote about this and it's primer. I don't use that word. Nobody uses that word. So I started thinking, like, am I supposed to do something with this? So I let it marinate and I realized, yeah, I'm like supposed to do something with it. So a primer is a short, concise book on one topic that gives people a clear understanding of it. And the other part that happened was, so this goes back to 2013, I had reached out to Gallup. So remember, people are thinking the heart guy is insane. So I decide I'm going to start writing. I'm not kidding. You know, I mean, this is what I was up against. So I thought, okay, what's my strategy? I'm going to have to play the long game. And the long game is I'm going to drip on people. So like read something and they go, huh, it's kind of interesting. Like he's not as insane as I thought. And then you read another one. That was my hope, right? And then I started the podcast so that people could literally hear that he's not insane. At least I hope your audience would agree. What happened was, I reached out to Gallup on a whim and ended up talking to Jim Hartner, who's the head of research, has been. He started not only their engagement survey study 30 years ago, but also coincidentally their well-being study. So I was looking for more evidence to say, has it gotten any better? Are people any happier? Because my theory or thesis was people are pretty unhappy at work and it's because we're leading them in a bad way. And so we just hit it off. And he tells me, we're about to produce a report, the American Workplace Study, and in it, it shows that only 30% of Americans are engaged. Now, I hear this, and I'm like, oh my God, mayday, mayday. And that's what everybody else's reaction was. But he gave me permission to put it in the article that I was writing. So that shot heard around the world that only 30% are engaged was in my Fast Company article in 2013. So I get this update from Gallup saying that engagement has fallen to an 11-year low. And I'm like, oh, man, that's bad. So I look at it and I'm like, they're the same numbers they were in 2013. And it was instantaneous. It's like, we've never taken this seriously. CEOs never took it seriously. Wall Street never took it seriously. So if you start there, it's all been performative, perfunctory. We do the survey. We take months to get the feedback out to people. We never held anybody accountable for it. Everybody's like, engagement is so important. We're at a point now where employees are like, stop this. Like, stop surveying me. You know you're not going to do anything with it. I told you 3 years ago I'm working for a boss that's unsupportive and you didn't do anything about it then. So we've just sort of made a mess of it. So that led to, what is really more important? And I read almost at the same time this study. I actually went to Oxford last December and met with him. But there was this remarkable study that shows that there's a direct correlation between week-to-week productivity and key performance metrics and how people feel week-to-week on their own self-assessment. How would you judge your well-being? If it's bright green, performance goes up. If it's bright red, performance goes down and everything in between. And I was like, eureka, this is completely aligned to everything. Simplify. But you used the word feel 4 or 5 times a moment ago. And we've never concerned ourselves with how people feel. But it's feelings and emotions that drive human behavior. It's not up here. This is one of the main theses of Lead from the Heart, is that we need to be thinking about how people feel and not how they think. So when we do a poll survey, we ask them, how do you feel this week? We don't go, how did you think about your week? And it tells you everything you need to know. Coincidentally, Hilton Hotels just got named the best place to work in America. And this is what the CEO is doing. He's constantly asking people, but he said, but it's not asking people, it's doing something with the feedback. So for organizations that want to commit to well-being, it can't be superficial. It can't be a head fake like it's been with engagement. And it has to unite leaders so that when they get the feedback, that they're getting together and they're talking about it. And then they go back out to their employees and they say, here's what we heard. Everybody wants raises. Okay, well, we can't give you raises, but we heard you. But you also said, and we can do something about that. So you're giving people this integration. You're giving people this meaningful voice. And it becomes more of a partnership, if you will. The employees aren't going to get everything that they want, but they're going to have a voice. And that makes people feel deeply connected. And that happens to be one of the huge drivers of well-being.
Got it. It makes a lot of sense. Engagement is not perfect. I actually wrote an article in 2013, probably around the same time, around in Talent Quarterly about the fact that engagement and the consulting industry is built on saying, hey, do you have some problems? Great. You do, because then you did a survey and we asked people and they're going to say things aren't perfect. And now we're going to come in with a plan to help you fix that. I mean, that is kind of consulting 101. The challenge with engagement is that, to your point, there's a lot wrong with engagement. Number one, it takes way too long to get back and focus on anything. It's used as a lagging indicator. It doesn't have that real-time metrics. And I think what you're seeing is more organizations who are forward-looking are using pulse surveys, quicker, shorter, more targeted that typically look at how that manager behavior and what's happening at that team level, because that's really where a lot of this is going to happen in terms of your day-to-day life, right? 80% of your job is going to be determined by your leader. Kind of now backing out holistically, you start to get other metrics of like, how do you feel about the organization, the purpose, the mission, the trust of the leadership? Do you support well-being? Do we support work-life balance or harmony or integration or whatever word you want to use there, right? Those things really matter. But engagement overall, I'm with you, I agree. It is a concept that is probably past its prime. And truthfully, someone who did their actual doctoral dissertation on the concept of commitment before engagement came out, you know, there's actual real kind of research constructs you use. Engagement's a little bit of a made-up term that is an amalgamation of like three different types of commitment. So it's been bastardized a little bit, and then we've monetized it. But I think to your point, the most important point we should probably underline is that I think employees are fed up with being asked for their feedback and things aren't changing. And that's always the worst thing we can do, is to have that survey. So I'm seeing organizations now push to 2 years, not every year on engagement. I'm seeing some do the pulse.
That's actually worse.
It's probably worse. I mean, I'm seeing there's that range. Some organizations want to do that, and that might be what they're doing every couple of years because of the amount of work. Some are doing more pulse, but the responding is the hardest part. That's really interesting. How do you see that, Mark? Are you seeing anything with AI giving us more real-time data and really getting back to managers that they can really understand like, oh, what happened the last 2 weeks didn't hit home, but now I need to do something emotionally and change my behavior to change the team and that, you know, change the environment for the team? Are you seeing things like that happening?
I actually just wrote an article about pulse surveys, so I'm a huge advocate for them. And for everything that you're just describing, the timeliness of them, the feedback is instantaneous. I don't really understand the maze that happens with engagement surveys, that it takes some months to get the data out. You can do a pulse survey, and in the next day, every senior manager in the company can have a copy of everyone's performance and say, oh, we need to hold this guy accountable. So if I'm a toxic manager and I'm getting results, and we do a pulse survey and say, how caring and supportive is the manager that you work for today? Hell no. I'm giving this guy a bright red, right? So if I get all bright red and you get green and everyone else in our team gets green, it becomes pretty obvious very quickly that there's a problem with Mark. This, I think, is the biggest issue with engagement that I have, which is there's never been any accountability. It's like, hey, Bill, looks like your team's not that happy, but you want to go to lunch? There's never been that holding people down and saying. So one of the things that Gallup has said that I've always loved, which is that everybody should have a great manager. The way that everyone can have a great manager is if you're doing enough pulse surveys and you're making sure that the person's boss is seeing it, their boss is seeing it, and everybody is discussing it, is that in my example, you as my boss would come to me and say, hey, did you see the results? Did you see how you compare? Let's talk about how we can improve these, because we need these to turn into green. We need your people to feel like you're a caring, supportive manager. Maybe there's some things that you need to learn. So we're coaching Mark to become better. But at some point, if my numbers or my scores continue to be that way, you're going to have a different conversation with me and say, maybe leadership isn't for you because you're harming people in the process. I think that's the biggest difference between this and engagement. This is very simple. And I talked to two major companies that are doing this. It's very, very simple just to go out with a couple of questions. That's the other thing that you said that I really want to pinpoint. Gallup's questions alone, 12 questions. One of them is, do you have the proper equipment to do your job? And another one is, do you have a best friend at work? So you get your results and it says, well, people aren't engaged. Do I need to get them a computer or do I need to get them a friend? And then companies go, well, we're going out with a survey. We should ask them about parking and we should ask them about the cafeteria. And then it becomes this huge data load that no one can digest, no pun intended. And ultimately, nothing gets done with it. So I love the focus of it and I love the commitment to it. But you know, the other thing that happens is that managers become better. When you're held accountable and you're seeing the results and you're seeing that people aren't really happy or they are happy, you're getting this regular calibration of, I think I'm doing a pretty good job or I need to improve.
Yeah. I mean, I think this idea of regular pulse surveys makes a lot of sense. What really, though, to make that really something that can be institutionalized is you have to have systems, processes, and a culture that drives accountability across those areas. that's one of the biggest gaps, to be honest. The amount of time it takes to then follow up, you can automate this, but somebody has to hold someone accountable as a leader. And one thing you said in the book I thought was really interesting, Mark, is you said employee well-being is on the leader, not the employees. Tell us more about that, because I think a lot of leaders would be shocked to hear that. They probably believe, hey, your well-being is your well-being. Why is that the leader's responsibility? But maybe just talk a little more about how you're thinking about it.
Well, it goes back to what I said at the beginning, which is this research that has come from Oxford. And there's been other studies too that corroborate that, including from Gallup. Interestingly, Jim Harter's doesn't mention engagement any longer. It includes well-being. So it seems to me that even they're kind of migrating into a greater focus around this. But the research was pretty clear that there's a direct correlation between employee well-being and their performance. If we just start with the basics, a leader's job is to drive performance and get results more than anything, then it might be in your best interest to be paying attention to well-being if you know there's a direct relationship to it. So that's the straight answer for it. There's another side of this, which is that this is what people want. So it seemed crazy to me, but we saw like 20% turnover in America in the 18 months following the reopening of offices during COVID. And you're like, why did people rush out of their companies right after they had been away from them for a year? And my conclusion, of course, is that they hated their companies. They hated working there. And they were like, I can't go back to that ever again. We had time to think about it. So that meant 20% of the population was willing to do something about it. That's a really bad sign for how we lead people. And I think it was just like, I'm not happy. I don't feel it there. I don't feel supported. People know me. I don't feel like a sense of belonging with my team, and I'm not growing, and all the kinds of things that contribute to well-being that would influence people to say anywhere has to be better. I look at that and I think companies have finally come to the realization that one of the worst things you can do for two reasons is allow massive turnover. One is just the cost of it. You know, recruiting and training and the lost internal knowledge. But the other is that there's research that shows that the longer teams are together, the better they perform, because they get to, I can anticipate what you are going to want from me. I don't have to come and ask you. I can go do it and go, hey, I did this for you. And you're like, perfect. That's exactly what I wanted. You couldn't do that if I was a new employee. I'd go, tell me what you want. And we're slowing things down. So I look at that and I think this was the thing that impressed me about the CEO of Hilton. He has reduced turnover by 50%. And it's like the lowest in this industry, in an industry where there's massive turnover. Like, people don't stay in hospitality very long, right? And I look at that and I go, well, why do you value that? Because if I'm going to go stay in a Hilton, I want people to know where things are and, oh, I know what you're really asking me, and all of that nuance that comes with having people stay. So if we start with, you don't want turnover, you want people to stay together, you want a cohesive team, and you want a highly producing team, knowing that this is what people want, then align to it. That's the answer.
Yeah, it's probably exactly what you said in the book. And I think it's a good one, because I just think sometimes we want to have individual accountability and responsibility. As a society, if you're in the US, you know, we're more individualistic in general. However, if we want to have leaders to have more accountability for things like turnover and for team performance, we've got to then say, well, why wouldn't you also feel responsible to impact well-being? And so I think that makes a lot of sense. One thing I realized that we kind of got into, we didn't really fully define well-being. Can we go back there, Mark, and just how do you think about, how are you defining well-being in terms of just the concept overall?
So the first thing we need to do is to differentiate it from what we've been treating it as well-being. We have this term wellness. By the way, our initial entree into wellness and well-being has also been very superficial, in the same way that engagement was. We're going to survey you, but we're not going to really do too much. So we gave people apps to meditate, and then we gave people free yoga classes, and we were basically treating the symptoms and not treating what causes poor well-being. So start there. It's not wellness. It has nothing to do with wellness. And well-being is really subjective. It's like what individually somebody feels. So one of the big surprises for me in the research is that the number one driver for employee well-being is belonging. And belonging is, I'm telling you, it's going to explode, because like, people are paying attention to this nuance. of well-being, and it's important, but it's very broad. So one is, am I respected for who I am? So this goes to Amy Edmondson's work in psychological and emotional safety. Can I just be who I am and be here on this team? But there's other element of it, which is, do I have a voice? Do people respect me? And do we work on a team where we're looking out for each other, or do we work on a team where we're competing with each other? So we set up systems where I evaluate you on an annual basis, and I go, well, you did okay, but not as well as the guy sitting next to you and the woman sitting next to you. And so all of a sudden you're like, that's my competition. Well, you don't want to compete on the team that you are, but we set up systems to reward people that actually do this all the time. So if you look at that and you say, okay, I want to belong, but I also want to have a sense of balance in my life, a little respect in terms of boundaries. We're very reluctant to give people boundaries. And what I found is that if you give people boundaries and they decide to break them, it gives them a certain sense of satisfaction. So I'll give you an example. Let's say we say, and I'm not advocating for this specifically, but I do like the idea of saying, I don't expect you to be working anytime before 7 or after 7. So we tell that to people. So I say to you, I'm not expecting you to respond to anything. And if I send anything out, I'm reluctant to do it. But if I do it, have my permission, don't do anything until the next day. If I'm looking at that and I say, I want to do that because that'll give me a heads up, or if it's an exciting project that I'm working on, then I could do that. I'm choosing. You're not imposing it on me or making me feel threatened, like I'm going to get laid off if I don't respond to this guy's message at 10 o'clock at night. But we need to be consistent. Your point earlier about there needs to be a cultural connection to this. It has to be, this is who we are and this is how we operate. And if people believe it, but then they decide to work with their own discretion, there's a sense of joy in that, actually, sometimes, not a sense of obligation. It just changes the psychology for people. So this is sort of complex, but really, it's what would contribute to my well-being? How would I say I'm feeling at any given time at work? Am I feeling overstressed? Do people understand the demands that I'm under? Do people appreciate how hard I'm working? Do they appreciate what I'm accomplishing? Are they expressing it? All of these things contribute to a sense of well-being. But it's interesting. One of the things I found about this is that in the Oxford survey, what they did was they worked in a call center, British Telecom Center. So everybody's doing the same job. When they first did the survey, the very, very first pulse survey, they asked people on a scale of bright green, very happy, to bright red, very angry and very unhappy, and everything in between. How would you evaluate, or 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, how would you evaluate your well-being? What they didn't say, JP, was, now, if you're going through a divorce, don't let that interfere with how you grade it, or you have some financial problems, or you got a long commute, whatever. They just said, tell us how you feel. And people were able to assess it and to understand, we're actually asking you this in the context of work. How does work contribute to your well-being? They could, no pun intended, again, divorce themselves from anything that was extraneous from work to say, here's how I'm judging it. And it was reliable. So when you go back to engagement with all the different explicit questions, if you're just asking one or two questions, you're going to get a very narrow focus that gives you tons of information that you can use immediately to elevate. So people are going to tell you what's going to elevate their well-being, is what I'm saying. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, I think we need to ask people more often what really matters for them. I mean, I think people want autonomy, they want agency, they want to feel like they belong. We just had Brian Miller on for Chief Talent Officer and D&I Officer from Levi Strauss. They're working on an initiative called Belonging by Design, and they're actually measuring the metrics of belonging in a much different way, but trying that back to actual retail metrics. And so it's exciting. So that's new. So we'll probably have them back on when they get the definitive answer on how that's working out. But trying some different things. And so I think belonging, there's a lot of words we use in HR. Here's the challenge, right, Mark? Even for employee engagement, employee well-being, lead from the heart, everyone has different perspectives of what these words mean. And so the most important thing as organizations, as HR leaders, is you get really tactical with your leadership team, your culture, your organization, and say, when we say well-being, this is what we mean. If we're going to measure engagement, this is what this means to us. And make sure leaders and managers understand that, because otherwise, we all have our own definitions. And that's why we think lead from the heart can be soft, or well-being might be only physical versus something else. And so I think that's the important point for me when I hear this. There's just a lot of noise in the marketplace, and the concepts really are truly universal, but you've got to bring it down into the company to make sure that it makes sense there. And the great companies are doing this, like you said. Hilton's doing this well. There's others that have really got this figured out, but they don't stay at the generic level. They figure out ways to pulse. They understand how people are feeling, and then they give mechanisms in ways that managers can make some impact. I think that's the holy grail, and that's the hard work for people to be able to do that.
If you're really committed to it, like it sounds Levi Strauss is, they don't know what belonging means to them, then go find out. I love the idea of experimenting and just testing and just asking people and learning along the way. What a cool thing to do, to say to people. Herminia Barra was on my podcast a few years ago, and we were talking about coaching. And coaching, amongst all the things that we ask managers to do, is like the lowest ranked thing. Like, managers hate coaching. So I said, well, we need people to coach. Like, I actually think managers should be called coaches. So what's the gap? And she goes, they don't think they're any good at it. In order to get good at it, you need to do it. But they don't want to do it because they're not good at it. And she said, just tell people, I'm not good at this. We're going to try to find our way, but we're committed to understanding how we might do a better job of supporting belonging at Levi Strauss. You've won people just by doing that, if as long as it's sincere. So we don't have to have it all. I mean, in my book, in Lead from the Heart, I was very clear on this is what it means. These are the practices specifically. This is what you do. So if you want to take it as a roadmap, same thing. I've got 13 chapters on what do you do to elevate employee well-being. So it's not this loosey-goosey thing. So you can start with, and it sounds like what Levi Strauss has done is to pull out the number one driver of employee well-being is belonging. So let's tackle that. I'm like, I am nothing but applause for that. Start somewhere. Make a commitment to it. Tell people that this is important to your culture and grow from there. But if you're getting feedback from people and they're saying, we would really like to see this, a lot of times you're like, I had no idea. I didn't realize that was going to be important. And the things we can give people. You think that they're going to ask for major things and give me a monorail from my house to the company so I don't have to drive. It's not the crazy stuff that people want that's going to make a difference. It really has to start. I love talking. We talked about this at the beginning, but I just love that we're talking to HR people, because I really think that this is a moment for senior HR leaders to say, we have enough letters on the board. We'd like to solve the puzzle. We believe that this is what we need to do. And we're going to experiment it. We're going to involve our leaders. We're going to be telling leaders that this is important. We're going to be doing pulse surveys. We're going to be sharing the results. We're going to be holding people accountable. And just watch how this organization transforms. I think that is the moment. And if I'm in HR right now, I would love to have something that meaningful. And then start with, what are the key performance metrics of the organization now? And then look at them 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And I guarantee you, to start with, how happy people are, how committed they are and productive they are, and whether or not they leave or not, all those metrics are going to get better. I would love to see HR take on that, because I think that's the place in the organization. I don't think CEOs understand this well enough. And you've got this incredible audience of HR people that are listening to this and wanting to be informed and say, how do I go about doing something that's going to be really transformational? This is it. Like, this is it. Move away from how we've traditionally led and lead that march is kind of what I'm saying. I really, really believe it. I think about it all the time. HR is the place for this.
Absolutely. I can tell. I mean, you're so passionate about this, Mark. And I think the audience will be fired up. You have a lot of people shaking their heads and saying yes and agreeing, like, we can do this. We are focused on that. And a lot of HR leaders are pushing and trying to influence their leaders to lead differently, have a different culture that's more about autonomy and performance and giving agency and belonging and well-being. And it's challenging. But let's get practical just for a moment, right? Because we're getting closer to the end. And if you're an HR leader, a CHRO, and your CEO says, okay, fine, you've convinced me. All right, I'm convinced. I read Mark's book. I'm going to go all in on well-being. What are three things they should do next Monday to get going?
first thing you have to do is bring your leaders together and tell them why you want to do this. Tell them why it matters. I would love that every leader in the company gets a copy of the book and reads it, and then I can retire. But that's not going to happen. And so I think it's really talking about where we are as an organization, where we want to go, and why we believe that this is the proper direction. It's that. If you really look at everything that I've been writing about, talking about for 15 years, is we need to hire caring people for leadership roles. We've never thought that this was important before. We've always hired the brainiest people. We've always hired the people that got all A's in school, and particularly in math and finance, and then we put them in charge of managing people, and they don't have any inclination whatsoever to actually support people in the human way that I'm advocating for and that science proves actually works. The second thing I would do is start to say, let's change the model of who we put into leadership roles. Rather than just teach people to become more caring and supportive of their people, let's hire people who've already demonstrated it. One interview question is, I say to you, JP, have you ever in your career, have you ever supported somebody and coached them and developed them so that they got a promotion? And you're in a job interview and you're going to fall for it. And you're going to go, of course I have, many times. Then the follow-up question is, tell me the person's name specifically. Tell me the job that they had, where they went, and what you did specifically that was you believe influence that person to get promoted. Not what they did, but what did you do? If you're on the spot for those answers and you've never done that before, you're going to all the way to the end of the interview. It's going to be a disaster. But if you have people saying, oh, this is what I've done in the past, and I worked in an ice cream store, and people that came in working, they were young high school students and really didn't understand how to treat customers. And so I took the time and I taught them how to do that. Now, you know, one of those people is running a Baskin Robbins. This is the way we transform organizations, is that you bring in people who already are modeling the behaviors that you're looking for so that people can say, oh, I see what they're looking for here. So you're enriching your culture by doing this. The third is introduce pulse surveys immediately. But as this, to your brilliant point, it has to be a system. Everybody has to be on board. The leader who's being surveyed has to be on board. His or her boss has to be on board. Their boss has to be on board, so that you're actually giving the results of the surveys to the third level in this scenario so that everybody can see them. So like if you're the senior manager and I'm getting bad results, I'm like, I don't want you seeing that. So now immediately I've got the pressure to fix that. Those would be the things that I would do immediately. And this is my dream. You will change the way people feel about work almost instantaneously by doing those three things.
Yeah, great advice. Really practical, really smart. I agree with all three of those in terms of making massive changes. So thanks for that, Mark. Last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Courage. Interesting. That's the one that just popped into my head. So the word courage comes from the Latin root cur, C-O-U-R, which happens to mean heart. It takes courage. You're seeing companies, Verizon just announced 15,000 people they're letting go, 15%. And we're seeing this left and right. It's almost as if Rhonda Morris just wrote this article about how companies are just, you know, letting people go left and right, and it's command and control all over. If I'm in HR, I need to have the courage to say, can I be the devil's advocate here and talk about how these decisions are going to impact us for the long term and how people are going to feel about our organization and understand that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction that we need to anticipate. We just can't just go, hey, let's let all these people go and it's going to improve our income statement and balance sheet and that's all and everything's great and we can go on, that there actually is a price to pay for this. That's who I think needs to have the courage to speak up and say, maybe we could do this in a different way. Maybe we could not hire people for the next 6 months and see if we can slow things down that way. Does it need to be so that dramatic? The other day when Verizon made their announcement that they were letting 15% of their people go, the market was down like over 2%, NASDAQ and Dow. But what stock was up? Verizon was up almost a point. So like a 3-point differential. So the market shareholders are pressuring and saying, oh, we love it that you're going to let 15% of your employee base go. So I know that that's the pressure, but there has to be a voice for the employee. There has to be a voice for the organization's culture. And sometimes the CEO pressure from Wall Street is just so high that if there's not courage from an HR standpoint, the voice doesn't get heard, the message doesn't get heard, and people are like, I'm never going to be loyal to another company for the rest of my life, which is kind of the one of the consequences of what we're seeing. And we don't want that. We want people to love working where they're working and to feel like they're building something and want to belong to something that's meaningful. Courage.
Well, I think that's really important. Courage is critical in HR, and courage to really believe in the power of employee well-being, which is the new book. Thank you, Mark, for being on the podcast. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Mark for a powerful conversation on why it's time to move beyond engagement and truly invest in employee well-being. We'll be back next week with a great guest that you won't want to miss. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.